Ours will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have part one of our interview with Francis Benfato. And Francis Benfato was one of the best bodybuilders to come out of France. And he was a very symmetrical and very aesthetic bodybuilder. A lot of people really loved his physique. And until today, people still recognize his physique as one of the best. We got a chance to talk to Francis at his hometown in France. And we have part one of our interview today. And today we're going to talk about how Francis Benfato got into bodybuilding as a youngster and some of the early competitions he competed in, all the way up until when he went into the Mr. Universe contest, which he competed in several times. And of course, I remember him from the 1985 Mr. Universe where Lee Labrada won. And I think Francis was like fourth or fifth in the middleweight division. But you could already see even then, even though he wasn't as developed as he would become later on, you could see the potential he had, the great shape he had, the very small waist. All right. And then after we have our interview with Francis, because I'm trying to get this interview with Rick Wayne, as you know, I've been talking about that for many weeks now. Rick had a book out, and I think it was like 1978, somewhere around there. It was called The Body Men. Very, very well written. So I'm going to read an excerpt from that book. And this takes place right after the 1975 Mr. Olympia, where Rick talked to many bodybuilders, Ken Waller, Robbie Robinson, Frank Zane, Franco, Arnold. So I'm going to read an excerpt from that article. Really, really well done. You guys are going to enjoy it. All right, before we get to that, I do want to mention our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. And tell them that you heard the ad on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. They will give you a free consultation. They will also give you 20% off your order. So talk to Jeff over there at Florida Alternative Medicine. All right. What else is going on? Of course, this coronavirus is still hitting us hard. I don't want to depress you guys with stuff you probably heard every day on the news, but the deaths are going up and more people are getting it. I don't know where you're living or how you guys are dealing with it, but I hope everybody out there is being safe and trying to stay inside as much as possible if you don't have a job that requires you to go to work. I know a lot of people are out of work, so that's another big problem. A lot of people are going to be hurting for money, and I guess they're going to be giving out those stimulus checks this month. The government's going to be sending those out, so that's supposed to be coming in a couple more weeks. Anyways, we're still dealing with that. I know a lot of people are not able to work out, and they're working out at their home gyms or they're doing whatever they can with bodyweight exercises. Because all the gyms are closed, and now I heard today, which is Monday, April 6th, I heard that they're going to be putting more restrictions on grocery stores. Like they're only going to be letting so many people in the grocery stores. So crazy, crazy, crazy times we're living in, and we'll see what happens. I guess it's going to last for a while, so we'll probably be going through this for another couple weeks. I did want to give you an update on Chris Dickerson. As you know, Chris, I think he broke his hip at his house because he lives by himself out in Fort Lauderdale. And when they brought him to the hospital, he had a heart attack. So a friend of mine, Bill Nealon, lives over there in Fort Lauderdale, and he's really good friends with Chris. I think I texted him today, and I asked him how Chris was doing. And he said he's stable right now, and he can't receive any calls. He's just resting. And I asked him if his heart was damaged at all from that heart attack, and he said, yeah, we almost lost him. He was on a ventilator for 15 days, and he had a cardiac catheter put in. but they have since removed that. So he said it'll probably be in intensive care probably, for a long time. He said Chris is now 80 years old and he's pretty frail. That's the news for Chris Dickerson, but at least he's stable and hopefully he'll be home pretty soon. All right, let me see if we got any emails from last week. We didn't get too many emails from part two of our Phil Williams interview. If you guys want to email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. That'll go directly to my personal email, and you can email me any questions you have or any comments about the show. I love reading those. Any suggestions you have for guests, anything you want to say, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. But I got an email from Rex Shiloh, and he said, if you haven't already tried, can you please give a great effort to getting Dave Draper on your YouTube interview channel? He just put out a book, so maybe that's how you can sell him the idea to be interviewed, since you'll help him plug his book. Also, he's getting on in years. If not now, then when? How many 60s and 70s superstars do we have left? Come on, John, do all you can. How could it not be a great hit? Time permitting, please respond. Well, I have reached out to Dave several times. I usually talk to his wife, Laurie, and she told me Dave is absolutely, definitely not interested in doing any more interviews. I guess he just gets stressed out when he does interviews for some reason, and he just does not want to do any interviews. So it was pretty definitive. I could try her again, I guess, but I think I got my answer. She definitely said that he does not want to do any interviews. So maybe I'll reach out to him because I did see his new book that he has out there. And so maybe he'll be interested in doing an interview. I'd love to talk to Dave Draper. He's a super nice guy. Reminds me of Bill Pearl, one of those really classy guys. Let's see, on my Facebook page, I got a couple comments on the Phil Williams interview. Glenn Kinnear, my friend Glenn Kinnear from Chicago, said Phil was always very sharp. And Mark Martinez, who said he enjoyed part one, he said Phil was fantastic and personable. Yes, Phil is very personable. On our Bodybuilding Legends show podcast on Apple, I got a comment, 5-star rating from Fit Guy Bree. He says, hi, John. I stumbled onto your podcast doing a search on bodybuilding. I was hooked after listening to the first show, and I've been binge listening ever since to catch up. I really enjoy your interviews with bodybuilding legends that I grew up with in the 80s. I especially enjoyed your show with Frank Zane, as I was a big fan of his. Keep up the great work, and I hope to hear more entertaining and informative shows. And I always look forward to the next show. I'll be at the Arnold Fitness, and I hope to meet you there. That was on March 3rd. So, yeah, that was before they canceled the Arnold Fitness, of course, the Arnold Expo. And John Min also gave us 5 stars. He said, great podcast for historic bodybuilding. Thanks, John, for very entertaining episodes. So thank you guys for leaving comments on the Apple podcast. So if you listen to our podcast on Apple, please go to the Apple Podcast page under Bodybuilding Legends and you can leave a comment. I think that helps our ratings. So if you could do that, I would appreciate that. I also put our Phil Williams Part 2 interview up on my YouTube page, which is under John Hansen. I got a couple comments there. The Spritz said, John, Lance Dreher would be an epic interview. He had lots of info on Joe Weider. And I told him that I did that interview with Lance probably a couple of years ago. So he went and checked it out and he said he thought it was awesome. Dark Solera said, that's crazy. I have both of those Iron Man mags. What's the odds? And now he was talking, of course, about the Iron Man magazines that I read the articles from in the last episode where I talked about Dave Johns and Lance Dreher. And Mark Valentino said, hey, John, you should do an interview with Tom Platz. And, of course, I have tried several times to get Tom on, but he will not do the interview because I guess they're writing a book about his life, so they don't want to do any interviews. Madden Shetty said, I love it when I get a notification about a new video from you on my cell phone. It makes my day. And Tom said, great content. You deserve more views. Yes, I agree. All right. That was our email. So if you guys want to email me, just go to naturalolympia@gmail.com. Or like I said, if you haven't left a review on the Apple podcast page, if you could do that, that would be awesome. And we also have a Patreon donors. If you go to bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, which is our official website, in the upper right-hand corner, it says become a Patreon donor. And I want to thank James Kerr, who was one of our Patreon donors, and he just doubled his donation. So thank you very much, James. These are difficult times. I know a lot of people are out of work. A lot of people are struggling, or a lot of people just don't want to spend money. So I really appreciate all my Patreon donors who are sending us money every month just so we can keep this podcast going. I also have a new page on my Facebook page. It's called Old School Bodybuilding Magazines. And I got a bunch of magazines here in the garage. So I'm going to try and get rid of them, and I'm trying to sell them on eBay. So if you guys are on Facebook, go to Old School Bodybuilding Magazines, and I'm going to be posting all the magazines that I'm trying to get rid of. So if you have any magazines you're looking for, maybe you could let me know on that page, or I'll post up what I got. It's going to take a while, obviously, to post them all up, but I'll be posting them up a few at a time. So just check that page out if you guys are on Facebook. And we got one more week in my John Hansen Fitness Challenge. We started this in January, right at the beginning of the year, and it was a 12-week challenge. And now, believe it or not, we are coming to an end. It's going to end on April 13th, which is next Monday. I want to thank all those people who joined up for the John Hansen Fitness Challenge, especially the ones who have stuck with it, especially over these last 3 weeks, which have been really difficult because a lot of people had their gyms closed, so they're trying to resort to working out at home if they have any equipment there, or they're just doing bodyweight exercises. And, of course, they're trying to stay on the diet too, which is really tough. So it's been a tough road these last 3 weeks for everybody. So those people who were invested into this John Hansen Fitness Challenge, I applaud those people who are still going with it and they're still continuing on. So we'll end it next week, and we're going to have the top three winners are going to get prizes. We're going to give them supplements from Old School Labs, and they're going to receive my videos and my books. Hopefully we'll finish strong, you know, with this challenge ending. I know it's been tough, so I appreciate those people who are sticking with it. Some people dropped out. I appreciate the ones that have stuck with it and are still going strong with it. And, of course, my bodybuilding seminar, we still don't have a date for that because I got to wait until the gyms open up where we can reschedule that, because that was supposed to be last month in March. And, of course, I had to cancel it because all the gyms got closed and a lot of people just couldn't make it, those that were flying out from other states and stuff. So I'll try to reschedule that as soon as possible, and we'll give everybody enough notice so they can make their way out here, and hopefully we'll get a couple of new people maybe to join the seminar. All right, so that is it. Here is our interview with Francis Benfato, one of the most classic and aesthetic bodybuilders of the 1980s and 90s. And this was from his home in France. We did this interview. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And we have a special guest this week, Francis Benfato. He's calling in from France. And Francis was one of the most aesthetic and beautiful physiques in bodybuilding, and he's still regarded that way today. So, Francis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I really enjoy speaking about what I have done so far, especially now because I'm writing with the help of a writer my biography.
Oh, great. Awesome.
So we just started 2 months ago.
Okay.
And so I have everything in mind when I started as far as 47 years ago.
Yeah.
I was 15 years old because I'm 62 now.
Okay.
And I started in a very modest way, in a sense that I had to walk to the gym, who was situated downtown at 5 to 6 kilometers away from my home. Mm. And so I was quite young, and we walked with a friend there to a gymnasium, and we started training with the basic, you know, barbell dumbbells and a few pulley, especially body weight stuff such as dips and chin-up and all. So it was a great memory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, honestly, it's like if it was almost yesterday.
I know,
I remember like it was yesterday. And I think it's because of my age. You see, you don't pay attention when you're in your 20s, 30s, and even 40s. You don't pay attention to that. But when you reach the 60 years of age.
Yeah.
I'm 62. The 7th of June, I will be 62. Now you realize, okay, this is from where I come from. This is what I did exactly. And it just makes sense. And it gives some understanding about all the work I have done since then.
Yeah. What got you into it, Francis? What made you want to start bodybuilding and lifting weights?
As far as I can remember, I was always fascinated by muscle. I remember when I was a kid growing up in Casablanca, Morocco, I was fascinated by muscular physique, muscular body, and especially aesthetic, beautiful to the eyes, looking bodybuilder, quite defined, proportionate. And I remember the first pictures I saw of a bodybuilder, it was someone from French island, Léon Césarion. And this man was in his 40s, and he looks magnificent. It was a triceps shot, the abs, the chest, and, mm-hmm. and the shoulder and the triceps was looking just absolutely magnificent. And I was fascinated by the look. And this is how it started for me. It was visual. And then after it becomes sensational, I mean, I sensed muscle working up because I had the opportunity to do horseback riding when I was in Morocco.
Okay.
I was doing jumping and dressage and all. And then when you're a child, I mean, a young teenager, and you ride horse, you're involved in terms of the physique, the body, but also the muscle. Mm-hmm. Because you have to keep the horse and make the horse to do some exercise and jump obstacles and all. So you work on your forearms, your biceps, your back muscle and all. So yes. The sensing was thereafter. So first it was visual. Then it was horseback riding who gave me the opportunity to sense my muscle working. Mm. And then after, when I was 15 years old, I had the opportunity to train, as I said earlier, at the gymnasium, and then I was like completely, utterly passionate by sensation, muscle sensation. And I was always behind sensing each and all muscle working out. That was what fueled my workout, the sensation pump. And I got a pretty much good pump at 15, 16 years old already.
Wow.
But I was behind that. That was my guideline, yeah. All my career until today. But it was what fascinated me, really.
Okay. Did somebody help you get into it, Francis, or did you just kind of figure it out yourself when you started training?
I would say watching the intermediate trainees. I'm not going to call them bodybuilder because it was a gymnasium. Weightlifter was there, principally. Okay. It was a weightlifting gym. Some powerlifter. Occasional training who went to the gym 2-3 times per week. And then a young teenager, and I was among the young teenager, but I could see already I was more passionate than the average teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to push hard and to train harder and to lift heavier weights than the teenager who was already training with me. And I did succeed. I did some powerlifting and I had some record for a good close to 2 decades.
Mm.
I was bench pressing for my body weight something like 220 pounds after only 1 year.
Wow.
So it was quite something for the body weight because I was a very, very light weight for 5'6". I was perhaps 120 pounds.
Wow, no kidding. No.
So it was good. So I could see already some aggression. I was aggressive in mm-hmm. a good sense of the term.
Yeah.
Passionate, and I really wanted to get stronger and bigger. And this is how I get into progressing quite regularly.
Yeah.
Regularly.
Now, you're known for having such great shape, such great genetics, you know, very aesthetic. And even today, people talk about you as like one of the most aesthetic physiques. I see your picture all the time on Facebook and everything. Did you see that at a young age when you were starting training and, you know, you were still just in the process of building your body? Could you see that you had that really nice shape?
I would say that, yes, because you compare yourself to the peers, you compare yourself to your friend and to the young teenager among you at the gym. So I could see my frame was different. The shape of my muscle was different. But I was a hard gainer, believe me or not. I was a hard gainer in terms of body weight. And it took me eons to gain some body weight and some muscle. But I was training so hard, so intense, and so frequently that I got to reach the level I wanted to reach quite relatively quickly.
Okay.
But yes, I could make a difference because, of course, my skeleton, I had and I still have a narrow hip, a small waist, and quite wide shoulder, mm-hmm. scapula, mm-hmm. to a certain extent, and so that's the base in order to look, to appear aesthetic, to have small frame, small joints.
Yeah,
that's help.
Right.
And then after, of course, the shape of each and all muscle. Some muscle like face are not as pleasant as other to the viewers.
Yeah.
Not as aesthetically appealing than other muscle. And me, I will say that my genetic, was a good genetic, a great genetic when it comes to muscle shape and muscle form.
Yeah.
The draw of the muscle, the aesthetic of the muscle, yes, that's an advantage. But again, I have to also say that I was out, you know, it was difficult to develop some specific muscle, but overall, all muscle, but some specific muscle, like the thighs, for example, I had a tremendous problem to develop my thighs.
Your thighs, really. Okay.
My arms was okay. I could develop my arms. I could develop my shoulder. My back was also coming along my chest, but definitely the lower body, thighs, glutes, hamstring, and calves was really a difficult part for me. It was weak point.
Yeah, weak point, yeah.
Simple as that.
Did you, were you reading the magazines a lot, like a lot of us? Were you reading all the bodybuilding magazines from America and looking at certain bodybuilders that you aspired to be like?
Definitely.
Yeah.
We need role model. We need example to look up to. And we need advice, we need recommendations, suggestion, and I had all with the French magazine, was already having some interview with American bodybuilder that was way ahead of us European, especially French. So yes, I was reading all I could in a French muscle publication as well as in Joe Wheeler publication, Muscle and Fitness and Flex Magazine. I don't know if Flex Magazine was there already, but definitely Muscle and Fitness, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Which bodybuilders did you look up to back then? Do you remember?
At that time, the popular one.
Yeah.
And the popular one was Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, Mike Menzer. That was the 70s. Menzer came in 1975, something like that,
right.
Winning Mr. America and all. And then after doing Mr. Universe in 1976, 1977, and Olympia and all. And, of course, Frank Zane.
Yeah.
Frank Zane, three-time Mr. Olympia. I was looking up to him. And we had a great bodybuilder in France, international, well-known bodybuilder, Serge Nubret.
Oh, yeah, Serge Nubret, right, absolutely.
And Serge Nubret has a magnificent physique,
also
very aesthetic, small waist,
right.
Narrow bone, and very pleasant to the eyes physique.
Yeah.
Really, really nice. So that was the bodybuilder who inspired me. But, of course, at that time when I was a teenager and I was looking at these pictures, for me it was a dream, which means that it's something that is – it's not achievable. You can't achieve this type of physique, this muscle development, this definition, this density. For me, it was just unreal. I was 15, 16, 17 years old, and it's still unreal until my early 20s. It's become, in my mind, a reality when I won my first Mr. France in 1982.
Mm.
So now I say, maybe I can go higher, but never I thought I could step on stage at Mr. Olympia, for example, never.
Right, right. Wow, that's interesting. So when you started, you never really thought you could ever get to that point until you got into your early 20s.
Absolutely.
And you won Mr. France.
I dreamt to. When I was a teenager, when I read Arnold Schwarzenegger was moving to America and signing contract with Joe Wheeler and doing Mr. Olympia and making great money, doing seminar and exhibition and selling his training advice, booklet, training advice, and all. I want it all. And I said, I want also to do that. I would love, it's a dream.
Yeah.
And I did after in 1991 when I signed a contract with Joe Wheeler.
Yeah.
I moved to California, I trained at Gold Gym and La Cosa. So yes, I achieved my dream, but I was 16, 17 years old when I was dreaming.
Yeah, right.
But really believing, it's another story.
Yeah. So when was your first contest then, Francis? What was your first
event? My first contest, I was a teenager. I was 17 years old, almost 18, and I was doing the qualification to do Mr. France. And so I won the first competition.
Okay.
The level wasn't that high, I must admit. but I won. Yeah. I won. Yeah. I think because of my, I will say, persistence and aggressiveness. I was aggressive, so backstage, on stage, I really wanted. And I think that make a difference. I really, when I step on stage, I really wanted. I remember my tan was running, my hair was wet, I wasn't looking good, I didn't pose well, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I won the first competition.
Yeah.
And after I did Mr. France, because I was qualified to do Mr. France, Serge Nubré was organizing Mr. France in Paris.
Okay.
And I was top five, but then it was a junior competition, which was in between 18 years old, I was just 18, through 21 years of age. So that was another story, and they look absolutely incredible. At 20, 21, you don't look like when you're 17 or 18.
Right, right.
Big difference at that time.
Yeah, you're more of a man.
So, yes, that was my first competition.
Okay. So after you won that first contest, did you think, wow, you know, maybe this is for me, I got something, I got a future in the sport?
Of course, because you don't know better. And when you go to Mr. France and in Paris and you see the competition and you see the junior, but you know what? Believe me, always when I saw the competition, even if they were so much bigger, harder, and more defined and all, it never got me to a point where I got disappointed and frustrated and I said, no, it's not for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was just okay. I was motivated. I was inspired, even if they were way ahead of me.
Yeah.
And I'm still like that. And somebody, because they're affected. I remember when I did Mr. Olympia, I watched at my competition from Lee Haney to Mike Christian to all the competitors, Sean Ray, Lila Braga. I mean, all the competition, I like it to watch and to see how they look and all. It didn't affect me psychologically. It fueled me. Because I had a completely different physique. I had my physical attributes, which was my aesthetic and my definition. Because and I also emphasize very much posing. So that was my attributes, and I step on stage with that. And there were differences. But at that time, we could compare.
Yeah.
Tall bodybuilder, small bodybuilder, light bodybuilder, and heavy bodybuilder, because we could make a difference, a distinction, with muscle shape, muscle density, muscle definition, posing. We had different character, different way of displaying our physical attributes on stage. It was different.
Yeah.
Today, they more or less, they play the same game in terms of posing on stage. The first round, second round, compulsory pose. They have the same procedure, process. It's almost like rule, regulation, or almost the same.
Mm-hmm.
When the judge asks a double biceps, for example, we have a way to show a double bicep that was unique, original. Lila Brada was doing a certain double bicep shot, or Lee Haney, or Rich Kaspari, or Sean Ray, myself including. So we had a different way of presenting our physical attributes. Today, no, it's almost, they do almost the same.
Right, right, yeah.
That's the difference. So we could compete. The point is we could compete with them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you did, how did you do that, Mr. France, when you were younger, the first time you did it?
So you mean the placing?
Yeah.
The first time I did was in 1980. I was top four. I was
top four. Okay.
And then after I won Mr. France, my first Mr. France in 1982.
1982. Okay. And how old were you then?
I was my age?
Yeah.
Oh, I was 27, I think, something like that.
Okay, okay.
Maybe early. 60, 80, yes, 24, 25
okay.
years old.
Okay.
Just
calculate. Yeah. So then did you have it in mind?
I was light. And again, the competition was high. The level was high. And I can tell you, backstage, two bodybuilders beat me.
Hmm.
In my eyes, in my opinion, The second and the third was better than me.
Really? Hmm. Wow.
Yes, but on stage, it was a different story.
Yeah, okay.
Because I could create an illusion on stage that was far greater and far better than my physique. So you see, the way I was displaying my muscle and the energy when I step on stage and all made a distinction, make a difference. But I remember their name, And I remember their physical attributes, their size, their density and definition. Honestly, they were like competitors. Huh?
Yes.
But I make a distinction. After, it's all about how you appear on stage, how impressive you can be.
Yeah.
What you can do with what you have.
Yeah. So they were better than you backstage, but you were better than them on stage.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
That's what I should then.
Yeah. That's interesting also what you said earlier about how you had that desire when you went up there. And I think when the judges see that, they recognize that. And they'll prefer that guy as the winner, you know.
Absolutely. The judge, they are passionate bodybuilders. They train also.
Right.
And some, they competed before, mm-hmm. and they stopped competing, and now they are judge.
Right.
And so they very much what it is, muscle size, proportion, harmony, symmetry, how to display physical attributes. They know all.
Yeah.
And so when they see someone who is alive on stage, who is passion, who has energy, it makes a little distinction.
Yeah.
That can help too.
And it's a subjective viewpoint anyways, right? Because they're deciding on their own who they think
absolutely.
Is
better. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree.
So when did you decide to do the Mr. Universe? Was that in your mind then after winning Mr. France that I want to go to Mr. Universe now?
Absolutely. You know, in Europe at that time, then what we did was first you win the national. Then when you win the national, you have a national level that you can now go to the qualification for Mr. Europe.
Mm.
So you go to the qualification, and if you're selected as the best representative in your division, in your category, weight division, weight category, then you can represent France. And I did Mr. Europe in 1983 in a lightweight division because I won my lightweight division during the French selection.
Okay.
So like the American team, you see, you have the lightweight and they represent America in Mr. Universe.
Right.
And it's exactly what I did then in 1983, 1986 or so for Mr. Europe. And then after when I was among the top in Europe, I said, okay, now it's time to try a higher level. Mr. Universe, Mr. World, IMDb World. And so I did Mr. World. And then when I reached the highest level, I got, Joe Wheeler was there. It was in Madrid in 1987 with Ben Wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
He was there for business also in Europe. And when he saw my physique, he told me, you want a pro card? And I said, yeah, I want a pro card. I'm here to win Mr. Universe and then to get my pro card. Because at that time, only Mr. Universe, Mr. World could win the pro card.
Right.
It was a way of having access to a pro card and to become a professional.
Right.
Because there's no point if you're not the best in your division as an amateur to go to do a professional competition.
I agree.
Because
yeah.
as we know, it's overall competition. There's no weight division, so the level is so much higher. And so I say, yes, it was my intention to win Mr. World in order to, and he gave me the possibility to become a professional, and so I did. And I did the Night of Champions in 1988. And another bodybuilder that you know very much was also starting his pro career at that time. His name was and still is, of course, Sean Ray.
Oh, yeah, right. That was his first Night of the Champions, yeah.
Started our career in 1988 in New York City for Night of Champions. Great competition, yeah.
Right, right. I want to take you back to 1985 when you went to Mr. Universe because I saw that competition on TV. It was on ESPN out here in America, and Lee Librada won the middleweight class, and you were fifth. But that was the first time I saw you, and I could see even then, even though you were lighter, you didn't have as much muscle mass, I could see you had that great shape. And I think even the commentators, Chris Dickerson and the other guy, they were saying, you know, what a great physique you had and how you had that great aesthetic. So how did that contest go? You looked a little disappointed when you got fifth. But I thought you really made an impact at that contest.
Yeah, maybe I was. I don't know. You know, when 46 competitors was at this competition, Mr. Wow. Oliver, 46. And we must remember one thing, is every competitor is the best of his country.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I was the best middleweight representing France. Lee Labrada was the best representing USA.
Right.
And so forth. And you have 46 competitors backstage, on stage, different lineups, waiting for the call-up.
Yeah.
So, yes, I don't really remember. Maybe I was disappointed, or maybe I was just tired, exhausted from the competition too.
You didn't look like you were angry. You just went like, I think the crowd was booing. That's what it was. When you got maybe, to the place, the crowd was booing.
Maybe it's the crowd who influenced me to be disappointed.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes all you deserve to win, okay, I'm disappointed.
Right. Was that your first Mr. Universe in 1985? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. It was my first universe. It was in Gothenburg, in Sweden.
Yeah.
And it was a great memory. The competition was really great. A lot of spectators. Great organization, of course. It was a wider organization since eons, and they knew how to really get a show at this professional, I mean, very well organized level. Yeah. And so I really enjoyed the competition, and I was quite pleased with my fifth place, because you remember one thing, it was the middleweight division up to 80 kilograms, and I was 73 kilos.
Wow, okay.
And Lila Brada was 80.
He was right there. Yeah, you're at the top.
He was right there, but you could see. He was right there, but you could see the ties, you know,
Long
ties, and voila. So, and it was my motivation, Lila Brada. When I saw him backstage, I think he was with Larry Scott backstage, or a friend or a coach, I don't remember. But I saw him, he was standing still with a tan and all, he didn't move. And when I saw him, I said, wow. And I was, again, admirative. I was inspired.
Yeah.
And I said, this is the physique I want to have. And I always was like that. When I saw someone and I say, well, I think I can get to this point. I can get to this level. I didn't really 100% believe I could.
Mm-hmm.
But I had this in mind. I had the idea. And then when I went back to France, of course, I worked to raise the bar.
Yeah, yeah. Did you compete in it the next year, in 1986?
Yes, I did the 1986 in Tokyo, in Japan, and it was a drug testing. We had a problem because, not too much of the drug testing, to be honest, because I was in shape, but the traveling and the time zone and coming only a few days before, honestly, it completely disturbed your physiology and then your psychology. Because when your physiology is disturbed, your shape is not the same. You lose the condition shape quite a bit because of the fatigue and all. Water retention, whatever happened, and your psychology is a little bit affected. But I was sure, so I placed higher than in 1985, in despite of the drug test, but I wasn't as defined. I was a little bigger, a little heavier, but not as defined. But again, I stepped on stage and I gave all I had, and I think the judge again saw that, and the competition was good. 1986, it was Jean-Paul Guillaume, I think, who won.
Yeah.
Mr. Universe, Jean-Paul Guillaume.
Yeah, he had a great physique.
Yeah, the small, tiny waist, huge legs.
Yeah.
He wasn't that developed. I was bigger upper body, but he was much bigger. The thighs was much bigger than mine.
Yeah, yeah.
So, he was a great poser, too.
Was he a good poser? Okay, yeah.
Jean-Paul Guillaume was a great poser. Yeah. Pleasant. Yeah.
Now, how did it go with the drug testing? How did you guys manage that? Did you just have to, like, stop using what you're using and then get off and make sure you pass the test?
Absolutely. It's a challenge because, you see, we as bodybuilders, we are used to do a certain procedure. And then after, you have to switch your procedure in order to be negative at the drug test. It's possible, but it's a difficulty and you have to adjust something else. And it's an handicap. We want or not, it's an handicap.
Yeah.
That's why they have problems with the drug test. That's why they only test randomly and only 5 competitors per category. And that's why also they stopped drug testing at Mr. Olympia, because we started the drug testing in 1990, mostly to be accepted as a at the Olympic, but perhaps for the media and to bring more interest to our sport was criticized because of the steroids used, presumably. So we tried, we did, but we failed in 1990 because most competitors was not as good as they were used to be, and some they didn't show up. They was there, but they didn't show up on stage because they couldn't, I would say, prepare themselves with the handicap of the drug test, because it's a handicap.
Yeah.
And I was right on. I was in great shape in Chicago.
You were, yeah.
I was defined, I was armed, and I knew how to prepare because I had that experience, but also because I never, emphasized steroid to a point where it become the main element of my bodybuilding, my contest bodybuilding preparation.
Okay.
It was, of course, part of, without, obviously, you cannot compete at this level.
Right, right.
But it wasn't really the main element. It was the cherry on the cake, if I can say. Mm-hmm. Training was first, nutrition was second, and posing also. And the chemicals were the cherry on the cake. And I started my career, I didn't use chemical for, 7 years.
Okay.
7 years. Yeah. So I started day one, 7 years after, I started with always in moderate manner for two reasons. First of all, it was ethical. And second of all, all my trainers, coach, gym owners, and at that time, make me to be fearful about the steroid. They spoke about steroid like it was a poison.
Mm.
Like it's a drug that you have side effect that you never come back from.
Right, right.
And I was young, when I started bodybuilding and all. And they pointed, bodybuilder was using as, you supposed not to do that. You see they are the way they are because. So ethically, I said, okay, I want to train hard. I want to eat well. I want to do this. I want to do that. But chemicals will always be the cherry on the cake. That was... Yeah. Always what I did.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was always like that.
Yeah, I've talked to bodybuilders from the...
Just 1 second, sorry. I'm just asking...
Okay.
Wife to... Maybe can you plug the computer, please? Because my battery is low. I don't know where is the call. Thank you. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I've been talking to bodybuilders from the 1980s, and a lot of them said the same thing. They said they were fearful of the drugs. They said they didn't want to take too many because they did respect the danger of taking steroids, you know?
Absolutely. No, I think then it was like that. And we also knew some bodybuilder with side effect, and we perceived bodybuilder as obtaining results without suffering that much. It's not true, because it doesn't mean that because you use steroid that you don't make effort, that you don't train hard,
right.
that hard and all. There is no a connection with that. But it was the way I was educated, and it stayed with me until present time. Even now, I'm still working for health, longevity, functionality.
Yeah.
I want to live a long life and to be functional and to stay in shape. And so I'm glad that I had this philosophy then, and I'm still have this philosophy today.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me a little bit about your training, Francis. Like when you started bodybuilding, you said you had the good structure, but you had to build more muscle mass. So what kind of training were you doing to do that? Were you training 6 days a week? Were you training less? Were you emphasizing the basic movements, heavy, light? What were you doing?
Yeah, I would say as a passionate bodybuilder all my life until present time, I had a tendency to train too long, too intense, and too often.
Mm-hmm.
And I could get away for that. I couldn't. So I learned a lot about training with heavy weight, training with form, training with sensation, doing, long training duration, and also frequent training sessions. So I learned a lot, and then after I managed more or less my energy. I was training in a specific way. I was training more intense. I tried to do high volume of work in a short period of time. Then other time, I took more time and I trained heavier.
Okay.
In order to be able to train heavy, you have to take more time in between, which makes sense.
Yeah.
I mixed up also both. For example, morning I was training heavy and afternoon I was training intense. And sometimes I was doing it in the 90s. I remember I was doing intense and heavy, two different muscles, and afternoon, heavy and intense, the same muscle.
Oh, twice a day. Twice a day you would hit.
Switch, for example, chest and back, morning,
uh-huh.
Chest heavy, back intense, and afternoon I switch it.
Oh, okay.
Back heavy, and chest intense. So each muscle was training the same day, one time with heavyweight, Basil compound exercise.
Yeah.
And the rest of time afternoon, intense, which means supersets or trisets, and more volume of work, more sets in a short period of time. So I was reaching the muscle differently. I was touching different type of muscle fibers too, the fast twitch muscle fiber and the slow muscle fiber, so the endurance one. So it was different type of training. I use all the methods, the cycle, the system, as well as training techniques such as double contraction, rest pause, drop set, to emphasize intensity. So I did all. Did all until the point where I create my own training methodology based on all I have learned during my amateur and professional career.
How did that work, Francis, doing the double workouts every day?
Honestly, it worked well. But remember, I was filled with enormous passion.
Yeah.
So that's helped a lot. So even if I was exhausted, overtrained, I managed to train hard because I had this belief that it was working. And it was, in fact, working to a certain extent. I don't think I will have had more results training differently because I gave so much to each and all workouts during so many times that I had a very good response. Well, you know, when you believe in something, it works to a certain extent.
True. Yeah,
right. To a certain extent.
And how about your diet? Did you have to eat a lot of calories in order to gain weight? Because you said you had a hard time getting weight.
Yes, I had a hard time to gain weight because I had a hard time to eat a lot of calories. And always, until present time, I have hard time to gain body weight and, I mean, muscle as well, off-season, because I have problem to eat a lot. You need at least, for someone like myself, to eat at least 3,500 to 4,000 calories a day.
Right.
Me, for my height and body weight, in order to make a distinction and to grow muscle, even if you are a little bit, I would say, overweight to an extent, and you don't have as much definition, it's fine, it's normal. It is what we're supposed to do in order to gain muscle.
Yeah.
I had always a hard time to eat so much calorie, especially clean calorie.
Yeah, you're not eating junk, you're eating good food. Yeah.
Exactly, so it's a lot of food. And that was my problem. But again, my best weight gain was when I did my comeback in 2006 at the Osan Grand Prix. I was 48 years of age.
Wow.
And so I did my longest contest preparation ever. So I trained almost the whole year, and I started eating more and more, adding more calories, extra meal here and there. And so I went to a point where I ate like easy 5,000 clean.
Wow, really?
And it was. And I went up to 100 kilograms.
Wow.
But off season.
Yeah. So when you were younger and you were trying to gain weight and you had a hard time getting weight, did you believe in bulking up or did you kind of stay lean all the time?
I didn't, but you see, at that time I was very attached also to my look, to my appearance.
Yeah.
I wanted to look good. I didn't want to look pushy. Right. I wanted to have waistline.
Right.
And all my life, even during my career, remember at that time we had all personality. We had character. We wanted to appear. Everybody was looking different.
Yeah.
On stage, backstage, during the conference and all. We wanted to look good. We had different type of clothing. I remember Labrada coming to the conference with specific outfit, and or Samir Banout or Lee Haney, myself. I was more sportwear. And so we had different character and personality. And I wanted to always look good. Well, this is competition time. Yes, you're supposed to look good anyway.
Yeah.
But even off season, I was very careful about to look good. It was important for me to look good, to be healthy, to be functional, to look good off season and not to be like, you know, too heavy.
Yeah.
And we had some French bodybuilder who went way overweight. Serge Dubré was going to 120 kilogram off season. It's huge for someone of his frame, for only 179 centimeter tall, which is like 5'11", something like that.
Right.
And he was 120 kilos. It's a lot of weight for someone, you know. And Jacques Neville also, and other bodybuilder, French bodybuilder, was gaining a lot of weight, 20, 25 kilos over their contest weight.
Wow, okay.
And they ate a lot, and I knew that. So I could get inspired, but I couldn't. I couldn't because I didn't want to look, to lose my look.
Yeah, that's good, kind of in a way. So you did it the slower way then.
Yeah, so I gained weight again, but it was more lean muscle gain.
Okay, gotcha.
I wasn't defined like competition definition, but I was quite.
Yeah.
I could do exhibition all year round.
Yeah, okay, you're always in shape, yeah.
Yeah, I was in shape, yeah.
So in 1987, you go back to the Mr. Universe, the World Championships, and you got second place that year.
Absolutely. I got second place, and Joe Wheeler gave me the opportunity to have my pro card.
Oh.
Because only at that time, only Mr. Universe, Mr. World could get the pro card. And
right.
I could. So it was an opportunity for me, and I didn't want to do again Mr. Universe because I did three times, and I got like, okay, I'm among the best. I can see the first. I can see me. I'm as good, if not better than him.
Yeah.
He's more defined than me, but I'm more aesthetic. I have more size. I'm more proportionate. So my physical attributes match his physical attributes. I'm as good as Mr. Universe.
Okay.
Joe Wheeler is coming and say, okay, Francis, you want your pro card? I say, yes, I want it.
Okay. I didn't know that. So Joe Wheeler just said, I'll give you the pro card because he saw the potential in you.
I think it was the first time he gave the opportunity to a professional, to an amateur, to become professional without winning Mr. Universe.
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure, but I think so.
Yeah. So tell me about 1988 when you went into the pros and you go to the Night of the Champions, which that had to be an experience in New York City, right? Because that was a real big contest. And that was a really big contest, too, in 1988. They had some great bodybuilders in there.
Oh, yes. I mean, Phil Hill, the actual one. With H-I-2-L, a black guy, was amazing.
Yeah.
And he won the Night of Champions. And he can compete today, and I can tell you, at Olympia stage, he was more defined than Mr. Olympia himself, and the runner-up and the show.
Wow.
More defined.
Wow.
Harder, and I will say as big, if not bigger. I will say bigger.
Yeah.
Especially the thighs. Much bigger than the actual Mr. Olympia. The thighs. But harder, more, and fibers everywhere, and thick back, very thick. He had a narrow scapula, but honestly, he was huge.
Yeah.
Huge, healthy, powerful, and amazing on stage.
Yeah.
And we are talking about 1988, and I'm talking about the Olympians today, and he can still compete today, I promise you.
Isn't that amazing?
You can see the pictures of Phil Hill.
Yeah.
Remember him, man? And I'm telling you, he was just amazing, mind blowing away.
That's over 30 years later, he could still beat those guys. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what my eyes saw. And Bob Parish was there, Sean Ray was there, Robbie Robinson, and other. But that's the popular one, top four.
Top four, right?
And other great bodybuilder. So I was pleased with my first place. I was 9, but I wasn't as good as I was during Mr. Universe in Madrid. If I was as good, I think I could have made maybe 2 or 3 places higher, which was quite amazing for the first professional competition for my height and all. I remember at that time Wayne Demille, the promoter of the Night of Champions, and the pro director say, Francis, come to New York, come to my home and the last 2 weeks and I help you for your preparation. I should have said yes. I should have said yes.
Yeah.
He could have helped me.
Why do you think you weren't as good at that contest as you were at the Mr. Universe?
I think I wanted to be bigger, and in order to get bigger you have to get heavier.
Yeah.
And that was my mistake.
Okay.
I was big, and my arms was big, and my overall body, I was bigger everywhere, but I lost conditioning. And if I had the same shape, I think I would have been maybe top 6.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Francis Benfato for that interview, and we'll have part 2 of our interview with Francis next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank my sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. And I want to thank all you Patreon donors who are generously donating to the show every month through our Patreon page, which is located on the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, or you can look under the comments here, and we've got the link there. All right. So as you know, I've been trying to get Rick Wayne to come on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I have been in contact with him, and he said he promises he will call me, and he promises he'll be on. So keep your fingers crossed, because that will be a great interview. I was always a big fan of Rick Wayne. He was a great bodybuilder back in the 60s and 70s, but then he went to work for Joe Weider, and he was one of the, probably the best writer, I think, in my opinion, in bodybuilding, in the bodybuilding magazines. This guy was so talented, such a, as great of a bodybuilder as he was, I think he was even a better writer. So he wrote countless articles for Weider's magazine, but he also wrote a couple books. And one of the books was called The Body Men, and I think this came out in the late 70s because the pictures on the cover are from the 1977 Mr. Olympia, so I'm assuming it came out like about a year later. Anyways, this part of the book, he is doing some interviews, and this is when he first went back to work for Joe Weider as a writer, and this was about 1975. And he did an interview with a bunch of athletes who were just coming back from competing in Pretoria, South Africa, in the Mr. Universe and the Mr. Olympia. So he talked to Ken Waller, and then he talked to Robbie Robinson. And in this part of the article, he talks to Frank Zane, and then Franco, and then Arnold. So I'm going to read all three of these sections. It says, Frank Zane came to the 21100 Irwin Street, Woodland Hills, after exactly 3 weeks of telephone calls to a Santa Monica apartment. A busy, busy man is Zane. Unlike Robbie Robinson, who I had never met until our first interview, Frank Zane had been a friend years earlier. We met way back in 63 in New York, competed in similar contests, and more than once carted off trophies. He to Tampa, Florida, where he lived in those early days, and me to London. Frank and Christine Zane were still just sweethearts when he dreamed of taking the Mr. America title on the same night that she won the Miss Americana award. They never quite achieved that ambition, but they were no doubt consoled by the doubleheader that they pulled off in London, Frank being declared NABBA Mr. Universe on the same stage on the same night that they slipped the Miss Universe bikini blue and gold sash over his wife's gorgeous tan shoulders. As I say, we used to be such good friends. We'd exchange long letters that conceivably neophyte bodybuilders would give an arm and a leg to get their hands on. For essentially, those letters were in-depth accounts of our own training concepts, discoveries, failures, and successes. All of this while I still lived in London and before Frank moved from Tampa, Florida to Santa Monica, California, and the bodybuilding big time. Yes, it seems big bodybuilding titles and time takes a heavy toll on friendships, no matter how strong. On the remembered afternoon that Frank Zane came to Woodland Hills to be interviewed by me, we got to talking about his fiasco appearance in the 1975 IFBB Championships held in Pretoria, South Africa, where Ken Waller became Mr. Universe. Zane's brown eyes flickered nervously behind slightly tinted glasses. He shifted uneasily in his chair, signals that told me clearly he did not wish to discuss the subject in any great detail. How very reminiscent of Robbie Robinson, who displayed similar reluctance when I tried to talk to him about the South African promotion, albeit for reasons vastly different from Frank's. But I had asked. Oh, I did very badly in that one, Zane allowed, eyes on some target over and beyond my left shoulder. I had a very heavy workload, what with summer school. I shouldn't have competed in the shape I was. Besides, I knew this was going to happen, the way I lost. I mean, I saw it all in my dream weeks before. One night in late August 1975, Frank Zane had this dream. I parked my car on a street, just a regular street, nothing special about it. There was no other cars parked in that street, only mine. I go off for a minute or so, but when I get back, my car is gone. It's vanished. Later, I discovered Joe Weider had moved the car to a huge parking lot where there are lots of other automobiles. I see my car, the driver's door is open, and papers are spread out all over the seats. I hurry to open the glove compartment to check my valuables, and I find everything intact. My Bank of America card, my wallet, cash, everything's there untouched. Safe. The dream was Frank's warning, which he ignored. The car represented my physical body, he said. Before the Mr. Olympia contest, I was on my own, following my own course, working for a degree, going to school every day, not training much. You see, I was on a lonely street. So then Joe Weider comes along and he puts me in with all these other bodies in the South African Championships. The scattered papers represented the fact that I didn't get things together out there. Everything got messed up. But, as in my dream, I didn't lose those things that are valuable to me, like my integrity, the principles I live by. I'm still the same person that I was before the South African Championships. My mind is not messed up. Now I just want to put the whole thing out of my head, forget about the contest. No point dwelling on something as negative as that. Now I'm getting my head ready for the 1976 Mr. Olympia contest. Arnold won't be competing this year. He'll be promoting the contest. This year it's going to be between Franco Colombo and me. Indeed. And what a storm of controversy the battle would create among the fans of Zane and Franco. But wait. Franco Colombo got his opportunity to talk about his own Mr. Olympia adventures soon after my meeting with Frank Zane, but he chose instead to perorate on his new career. It seemed hardly possible he could be the diffident little Sardinian I used to know in the old days back in Europe, who used to always walk in the shadow of his gargantuan friend, Arnold Schwarzenegger. In those days, Franco was barely able to order a glass of water in English. Now he was overflowing with self-confidence as he told me proudly of a movie project in which he was scheduled to participate, the bodybuilding seminars that he signed to hold in different parts of the world, and the various difficult examinations he had already sat and passed in his efforts to become a doctor of chiropractic, like his beautiful wife, Anita. And all of that he related in near perfect English. If Joe Weider never again performs a charitable act for the rest of his life, his decisions to bring Franco Colombo over to the United States will stand him in good stead on the journey through limbo. When at last Franco got around to discussing the 1976 Mr. Olympia contest, he talked as if the event was already down the tube of deja vu, even though it was at that time some 6 months in the future. What he said left absolutely no doubt in the writer's mind that Franco believes deep in his marrow that he should have beaten his friend Arnold on their last encounter in South Africa. Before that, too. They gave Arnold the money, he said, but who cares? I know he didn't beat me, and he knows it. It was just one judge's decision, Charles Gaines, I believe. Still, I am what I am in this game, and nobody can take that away. Nobody. You will see that I will be unbeatable in this year's Mr. Olympia. Of course, I realized Franco was talking this way safe in the knowledge that his chief adversary, Schwarzenegger, had decided 6 straight Mr. Olympia wins were enough to convince the world, let alone Franco, of his invincibility. In fact, Arnold would be promoting the contest that Franco had set his heart on winning. Arnold and his partner, Jim Lorimer, the same Lorimer who staged the first contest between Arnold and Sergio Oliva that Oliva did not win. As if to underscore his status in bodybuilding at the time, the message might have well been pregnant with more ominous content, as we shall see later. Franco picked up a notepad on my desk and he began to draw. You see this ladder, he said, pointing to his handiwork? It shows you clearly where I stand. On the very top rung of this ladder, you have myself, Arnold, and Sergio. On the second rung is Lou Ferrigno and Frank Zane and Ed Corney. On the third rung, you have Robbie Robinson and Dennis Tenorino and one or two of the others, maybe Boyer Co. Then on the fourth rung, there are Roger Callard and Eddie Giuliani and other small fry guys like that. The next rung is for the Mr. Los Angeles fellows, nobodies, and so on. I think this is a clear picture of the situation right now. Perhaps it was at the precise moment of Franco's boast, it could not possibly have been more than an empty crowing on his part, of that I was certain that I had made up my mind, my subconscious mind yet, to cut this little man down to size. How dare he talk of his infernal status ladder on which he had chosen to assign me no rung, while I sat right there beside him, rang the fury of my abused half-comatose ego. After 6 years of bodybuilding inactivity in the Caribbean, 6 incredible years of living the body-crucifying existence of the newspaper journalist, of taking sustenance on the run, which is to say, coffee, Coke, hamburgers, the wiser part of me insisted that it made no sense, no sense at all, considering even for a moment the possibility of a comeback against the likes of Zane and Waller and Robbie and Franco, monsters all whose fangs were forever sharp from regular contact with the grindstone of top-level competition. But deep in the pockets of my well-oiled vanity, I knew I would try. I would try to pull off the biggest upset in the whole vicissitudinous history of bodybuilding. If it killed me, I had to find out whether or not I could make Franco eat his ego-sodden words. I'd send him crashing from the highest rung of his self-constricted status ladder or expire in the attempt. Arnold Schwarzenegger was involved in all manner of cinematic things when I first came to California. I tried hard to reach him, and I was greeted 100 times by his answering service. Arnold's not at home right now. Please leave your name and number. Arnold will return your call. In fact, Arnold was in Canada and Ohio and Belgium, New York, everywhere but Los Angeles where I wanted him. And then one evening, as I was putting on the cover to my IBM Selectric, my desk telephone started to ring. "Hello," I say, "Rick Wayne here. Can I help you?" "Ricky," says the voice in my ear. "This is Arnold." And like a jackass, I brayed, "Oh, hi, Arnold. How are you doing? Where are you? When'd you get back?" When all along I'd planned to say, "Arnold? Arnold? Arnold who?" For I had got word that Arnold, who had been my friend, oh, from as far back as 1963, when we both lived in Europe, was making decidedly unfriendly noises every time my name was mentioned. And all because, here we go again, of some article that I'd written for a Canadian magazine, Muscle Mag, in which I had made mention of the famous Reg Park Schwarzenegger contretemps in London, when the Austrian had done things to Park's fragile ego that you wouldn't do to your neighbor's pet stink. That and some other references to the Sergio and Arnold battles. It was difficult believing the Arnold that I knew had been so disturbed by a magazine feature, for the old Arnold had always taken the written word with a pinch of salt, as they say. As far as he was concerned, it didn't matter what a journalist chose to write about him if he got the name right. Well, anyway, there he was on the line in a most gregarious mood, too, like the old Arnold, even offering to take me out to eat and maybe talk about the old days. Unfortunately, I had other plans, but he took it well. "Okay," he said. "So why don't we make a date to meet the minute I get back from San Francisco? I just got in from New York. I've been doing something with Zane and Corny at the Whitney Museum of Art. We'll talk about that on my return to L.A. I could hardly trust my eyes when the great one sauntered into my Woodland Hills office a few days later. That was the mumbling gouch brute from Graz. He looked more like an off-duty Hollywood actor than the guy who only a few months earlier had devastated all competition in South Africa to win the Mr. Olympia title for the sixth time. This Arnold was lean in skin-tight blue sweater and faded jeans. There were streaks of fashionable gray in his longish brown hair, and he sported a South of France tan. And on his feet, he wore bohemian sandals. Honest, Arnold looked like Jesus Christ after a shave. He lowered himself into a chair and almost immediately began to transcendate that famous Schwarzenegger professional charm. Yes, it poured out of him like bubbles from a bottle of mum champagne. He seemed completely relaxed, at ease with his new lifestyle. He laughed a lot and easily from deep down in his gut. His self-confidence was near intimidating, and yet Arnold never once tried to impress me with the fact that he had just won the top bodybuilding accolade for the impossible sixth time. As if he knew exactly who he was, and he took it for granted that I knew too. Ergo, there was no need to prove anything to me, no point in showing off. There are some cockeyed optimists who persist in the apparently comfortable belief that bodybuilding is now an established sport, fully accepted by the general public, and independent of any one particular star. Fry them in oil for being so utterly naive. Without Arnold Schwarzenegger, the sport would be 100 times the poorer and still encumbered by the ugly stereotype image that finally we have managed to bury. Praise Arnold, who is now the darling of the press, whose television image has done wonders for the sport, who's made a point of appearing normal to media folk from here to Baghdad. Yes, Arnold it was who took us into the bedrooms of America, seduced wives into looking at wasted sons and paunchy husbands with new eyes, eyes full of wanting, whatever it was Arnold stands for. Now he's going over the last few years of his life for the benefit of Muscle Builder readers. I'm interviewing him for a special feature. "Reg Park always had a special place in my heart," he says, the vocal left jab landing high on my forehead, dazing me just slightly. I collected his pictures for years. I dance away from that one. I let it go over my shoulder. And the greatest thrill of my life was when I finally met him at a show in London that we did together. You appeared that night too, didn't you? A Wag Bennett show. I can see the verbal thunderbolts coming a mile off, but I'm still powerless to stop them. They land effectively. He's doing the Ollie Shuffle now. I remember Reg Park and I had something of a disagreement in a dressing room in London when we both competed for the Mr. Universe title. Well, now I've given much thought to the whole episode, and here it comes. I'm sorry it ever happened. Reg has always been my whole inspiration, the man that I've always tried to emulate, my hero. I really don't know where I would be today had it not been for Reg Park's inspiration and his example. Wop, bang, zing. The verbal left hooks were coming in from all directions, landing smack on target, overloading my nervous system, so I was mentally powerless to cope. Well, anyway, he went on, my ego got in the way of good sense back there in London, and I said things that I didn't mean, things I now regret. It had to be just a matter of time before the big one that would put me out of my misery. I said foolish things that must have been so hurtful to Reg, but he's such a good man, such an experienced man, he forgave me. And now we are all, his family and me, we're all good friends, as it should be, right? The knockout combination. Later, after replaying my tape recording of the interview, it became clearer still what a scheming son of a bitch Arnold really is. He had cleverly calculated the whole thing as a means of making amends, pacifying Park after what I'd written earlier of their relationship. He had much fun commenting on Franco's status ladder, whose top rung the Sardinian said he shared with Sergio Oliva and Arnold. I don't know about Franco's head anymore, the interviewee had observed. First, he gets the IFBB to introduce weight divisions into the Mr. Olympia contest to accommodate his ego, and when that does not work, he tells himself that he's better than Arnold anyway. Listen, there's nobody up on the top rung, nobody but Arnold. On the second rung, I see no one at all. It's vacant because there's no one who comes even close to taking me out, not even Sergio, as you already know. On the third rung, I see Robbie, Franco, Lou, the rest of the guys. Now tell that to Mr. Colombo for me. He must have laughed his head off all the way up the Santa Monica Freeway. As I say, it felt good to be back. More than that, I was soon training again after a layoff of some 6 years. Yes, I had also decided to try my luck in the 1976 Mr. Olympia contest. I chose Vince's in North Hollywood for my preparations for two reasons. One, the gym is close to where I live. And two, it afforded me the opportunity to train semi-secretly. I had no great desire to battle Waller and the others before Olympia Day. My workouts proved more productive than I dared to hope, so productive that with 3 months to go before the Mr. Olympia, I accepted an offer to appear as a guest star at a Joe Corsi promotion in San Jose. Also appearing were Franco Colombo and Ed Corney, both of whom I'd be facing in the big battle ahead. But of that, more later. All right. Great, great book, The Body Man from Rick Wayne. You guys get a chance to get it on Amazon. I highly recommend it. Rick's a great, great writer. All right, that's it for the show. I want to thank again our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, and all our Patreon sponsors for supporting the Bodybuilding Legends website. And we will see you guys next week with part two of our interview with Francis Benfato. Take care, everybody, and stay safe. We'll see you then.